I want you to cast your mind back to when you were a little younger and think about the plans you had for your life. Now, I know some of you aren't that old in the first place, but maybe you can go back a year or two and think, what did you expect your life to be like at the time it is now? And maybe you can think of a few things that aren't the way you intended them to be. Perhaps you intended at this point to have that fulfilling career that you really wanted. Perhaps you planned to be married, but now for a various amount of reasons you're alone. Perhaps you planned at the very least to be feeling happy in your life, and now you're crippled with regret and sorrow. Your plan for your life and what's actually happened in God's plans have been so different. What do you do with that? Well, that's the situation when we come to this passage for the two men that are the focus of it, David and Saul. Now, if you've been here through the weeks, you'll know that Saul is kind of the bad guy of this story. He's the king who went against God, who one day is going to be removed. He's getting worse and worse and worse as the weeks go on. And God is going to replace him with King David. And he's frustrated. He can't believe that the throne, which he didn't actually want in the first place, but now he's got so used to, is going to be taken away from him. He's frustrated in God's plans. But actually, it's no different for David. Again, David didn't particularly want to be king. He was appointed as king. And he isn't whisked away to the palace to live a life of luxury. But he is at this moment homeless, hungry, sent out in exile and shame. Both of them have their plans frustrated. But they approach very similar situations in very different ways. And so as we look at these two different men, God wants to see you how to not approach your plans being frustrated and how to approach your plans being frustrated a wrong way and a right way. So we're going to start with Saul. It is actually the last in terms of the time order, but it's nice to finish on a positive rather than a negative. So we're going to start with Saul. And we see in verses 6 to 23 of chapter 22 what read for us, that Saul is frustrated by God's plans. As we start this passage, he's seething with jealousy against David. He wants to find David. But as we see, when we look at the David part of this passage, David has been discovered, he's been seen by one of Saul's men, but he's escaped. And what's Saul's response going to be to that frustration? We see in verses 6 to 16 that God's plans frustrate Saul. His officials come to report to him, and you see in verse 6 that Saul sat under a tamarisk tree, spear in hand. Now that's quite an aggressive posture. Remember, a spear is a weapon. He's kind of playing with his spear whilst these men are speaking to him. It's a bit like a mafia ganglord kind of cleaning his gun quite deliberately, as some people come to report to him a problem. And he unleashes anger at them. Verse 7, "Listen, men of Benjamin, will the son of Jesse," that's David, "give you all fields and vineyards? Will he make all of you commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds? Is that why you've all conspired against me? No one tells me when my son makes a covenant with the son of Jesse. None of you is concerned about me or tells me that my son has incited my servant to lie in wait for me as he does today." All of this is paranoid, isn't it? Although God's appointed David as the next king, David isn't trying to take the throne by force. He's willing to let things take their course. He's made no bribes. He's not offered people promotions. His friendship with Jonathan was just to protect him, not to cause a rebellion. Saul is convinced that these things are true. Now, Doeg the Edomite, he feeds that anger because he has seen that Ahimelech the high priest gave David provisions and gave David the sword of Goliath. And that means that King Saul hoiks up Ahimelech to come before him. Verse 13, he says to the high priest, "Why have you conspired against me? You and the son of Jesse, giving him bread and a sword and inquiring of God for him, so that he has rebelled against me and lies in wait for me as he does today." Well, Ahimelech's a little taken aback because, as we'll see when we read the David part, David told him he was on a secret mission from Saul. And as far as he knew, Saul and David were fine. So he says this, verse 14, "Who of all your servants is as loyal as David? The king's son-in-law, he married your daughter, captain of your bodyguard, and highly respected in your household. Was this day the first time I inquired of God for him? Of course not. Did not the king accuse your servant or any of his father's family? For your servant knows nothing at all about this whole affair." And that's true. Saul's accusations make no sense, but Saul won't have any of it. He's convinced that because his plans aren't being fulfilled, that he is being got at by everyone, that everyone is against him. Do you ever see that in your own life? You create a narrative, a story about the world that makes everyone else the villain and you the victim. You imagine that everyone's talking about you, when the reality is they have enough problems of their own to be bothered about you. You presume that people that you loved and trusted are out to get you. You think there's a conspiracy against you when there's nothing of the sort. The reality is that God has decided what's best, and it's him that Saul is up against. But Saul can't change God's plans. And so he just sees with rage against all those around him. That's so often what we do. When our life doesn't go the way we want, we can't change God's plans. We hit out at those around us. And we see that God's plans are opposed by Saul in verse 16 to 19. He turns to his guards and says, "Turn and kill the priests of the Lord, because they too have sided with David. They knew he was fleeing, yet they did not tell me." But the king's officials were unwilling to raise a hand to strike the priests of the Lord. He's asking them to kill the priest, the representatives of God on earth. That was a big thing. And those men, quite rightly, refused to do that. So what does Saul do? Does he come to his senses and say, "No, this is ridiculous. I can't destroy the whole priesthood"? No. Turns to the one person there who isn't an Israelite, who has no problem at all with killing a priest, Doeg the Edomite. And he orders him, "You turn and strike down the priests." So Doeg the Edomite turned and struck them down. That day he killed 85 men who wore the linen ephod. He also put to the sword Nob and the town of the priests, with its men and women, its children and infants, and its cattle, donkeys, and sheep. Saul is siding with the enemies of God against God and his priesthood. To devote the priests and their families and their flocks to destruction isn't just an act of mass murder. It is that. But it's actually an act of rebellion against God. It's an act of self-worship. Anyone who doesn't agree with me must be destroyed. And that's what sin does. Now, most of us are never going to be in the position to murder someone who gets on our nerves. But Jesus says at heart, anger and murder are the same sin. So we might not murder, but we might let loose a torrent of rage at people around us. Or we might be more subtle, gossiping about them in back corners to undermine them. Or like Saul, we might start to side with the world against God's people. And this is all an act of self-worship. It's saying God is doing a terrible job of running the universe, and me, by my anger and frustration, I'm going to show that I should be in charge. But what difference do Saul's actions make? Can Saul defeat God's plans? No. God's plans stand despite Saul. Look at verses 20 to 23. Saul attempted to wipe out the entire priesthood, but we read, "One son of Ahimelech son of Ahitub, named Abiathar, escaped and fled to join David. He told David that Saul had killed the priests of the Lord. Then David said to Abiathar, "That day when Doeg the Edomite was there, I knew he'd be sure to tell Saul, 'I'm responsible for the death of your whole family. Stay with me. Don't be afraid. The man who wants to kill you is trying to kill me too. You will be safe with me.'" So one priest survives. David accepts his responsibility, and that we'll come back to that later when we think about David. But this leads him to keeping this man safe, Abiathar. At the start of this whole process, the priesthood was loyal to Saul, but now the one remaining priest is with David. God's plans stand. He intends to make David king, supported by his priests. And despite all that Saul does, that plan remains. Standing against God's plans is always utter foolishness. You can never beat him. You can be angry all you want at him or the people around him. You can hit out at God's people all you want, but it will do nothing to change God's plans, which stand forever. Some of you are here this morning and you refuse to accept God as the Lord of the universe. Why? Well, because, like all of us, you think you do a better job than he does. You think your rules are better than his rules. Your plans are better than his plans. That's foolishness. Look at Saul here. He's angry, he's paranoid, he's friendless, and that's where every sin leads. You may not see it now, but if you rebel against God, you are on that track. Repent. Say to God, "I am not the Lord of my own life. You are the Lord. I bow the knee to you." And Christians, although we outwardly might acknowledge Jesus as our King, this can happen for us too. If you want to see where you're rebelling against God, anger is a good place to look. What makes you angry? Now, there are some times when we get angry about real injustices, and I don't want to say that that's wrong. There are things in the world that should make us angry. But if we're honest, so often in our lives, the things that make us angry are things that hurt us and our little kingdom. When were you last angry? Who were you last angry at? What were you angry about? And what does that show about who you really worship? And second question to ask from this passage would be, where are you siding with the world against God's people? Saul ends up with Doeg the Edomite against the priests and all of his own men. They're all saying this is wrong. And often, we will, in our sin, side with the world against God and his people. Now, again, there are caveats. Sometimes churches do get things wrong. I'm not saying mindlessly accept everything that Christians believe. But it's worthy to ask the question, if you are being divided from the people of God, is that because you are being a martyr for the truth? You are the one faithful person. Or is it that your selfish plans fit so much better with the world than they do with God's people? Saul was frustrated with God's plans. He opposed God's plans. And ultimately it changed nothing. Because God is God. Fighting against God is never the best way to live your life. But what about David? David's in a similar position. His plans are equally frustrated. He never asked to be made king, but God anointed him as king. And as a result, he's a fugitive. He's sleeping rough. The fact he comes here begging for bread shows that he is starving. And this is going to continue for year after year. He's separated from his wife. He's separated from his best friend. He had all the reason in the world to be angry at God and his plans. And yet what we see is that in the midst of all this, God keeps David. God's plans provide for David. We see that in verses 1 to 9. Now, we didn't read this before, so I'm just going to read it through. You might want to follow along. 1 Samuel 21, verses 1 to 9. This is before what happened, okay? Which we've talked about before. David went to Nob, to Ahimelech the priest. Ahimelech trembled when he met him and asked, "Why are you alone? Why is no one with you?" David answered Ahimelech the priest, "The king sent me on a mission and said to me, 'No one is to know anything about the mission I'm sending you on. As for my men, I've told them to meet me at a certain place.' Now then, what have you to hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread or whatever you can find." But the priest answered David, "I don't have any ordinary bread to hand. However, there is some consecrated bread here, provided the men have kept themselves from women." David replied, "Indeed, women have been kept for us, as usual, whenever I set out. The men's bodies are holy, even on missions that are not holy. How much more so today?" So the priest gave him the consecrated bread, since there was no bread there except the bread of the presence that had been removed from before the Lord and replaced by hot bread on the day it was taken away. Now, one of Saul's servants was there that day, detained before the Lord. He was Doeg the Edomite, Saul's chief shepherd. He's the one who dobs Ahimelech in. David asked Ahimelech, "Don't you have a spear or a sword here? I haven't brought my sword or any other weapon because the king's mission was urgent." The priest replied, "Sword of Goliath the Philistine, whom you killed in the valley of Elath, is here. It is wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod. If you want it, take it. There's no other sword here but that one." David said, "There's none like it. Give it to me." And one of the things that's difficult about that passage is David lies, doesn't he? He's definitely not on a secret mission from Saul. Saul's trying to kill him. Now, some have argued that David gets a kind of special dispensation at this point because of his circumstances. But given that he apologizes at the end of chapter 22 for the death that comes to the priest, I think that suggests David was wrong to make that lie and put the priest in such danger. But the passage focused not primarily on the rights and wrongs of what David has done, but how God is working for David through these sufferings and trials. Through this, he's fed and he's armed, isn't he? He's given exactly what he needs. He's given bread, he's given a sword. But what that bread and sword are very important. So first, he's fed with the consecrated bread. It's meant to be only for the priests. Now, if David marched in there and took this bread for himself, he'd be in big trouble because he'd be overstepping the boundary. But actually, God's priest is offering it to him. And we hear later on that that this was an act of God then consulting God. It mentions that in chapter 22, doesn't it? So it seems that God's priest consulted God to find out whether he could take this bread and give it to God. And so the priest is offering it to David. Now, Jesus refers to this story in the New Testament, as many of you will know. If you're quick at flicking, you might want to go to Luke 6. Or if you've got a phone, you could do that quickly. But you don't have to. Luke 6, verses 1 to 5. This is the occasion. One Sabbath, Jesus was going through the cornfields, and his disciples began to pick some ears of corn, rub them in their hands, and eat the grain. Some of the Pharisees asked, "Why are you doing what is unlawful on the Sabbath?" So they're accusing these men of working on the Lord's day. Jesus answered them, "Have you never read what David did when he and his companions were hungry?" The story that we have here. He entered the house of God and, taking the consecrated bread, he ate what is lawful only for priests to eat. And he also gave some to his companions. Then Jesus said to them, "The Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath." So I think Jesus' point depends on the fact that David is given some kind of special dispensation because he's God's chosen king. But he's able to take this bread because he's God's chosen king. And it's the same with Jesus. He's the Son of Man. He's the appointed king of God. And that's why he's able to decide what should and shouldn't be done on the Sabbath. So that seems to suggest that this bread being given to David is significant. It's showing that he's God's man for the job. And the sword's significant too. Do you remember a few weeks ago that there was only 2 swords in the whole of Israel, and that Saul and Jonathan had them, but nobody else did. They were quite rare. They were quite the Philistines had prevented the blacksmiths from making any swords. So the fact that he finds a sword is significant, but which sword? It's Goliath's sword. David, being supported by God, killed Goliath, and he was given that sword as a result. And this is no doubt God reminding David, just as I rescued you from Goliath the giant, I'm going to rescue you again by arming with you with this sword and protecting you when Saul is against you. So there's God providing for David. There's lots of other things going on there. We'll talk about it a bit, a small group on Tuesday night, but that's the main focus. God's providing for David. And a similar thing happens in verses 10 to 15. This is even weirder. I'm going to read it again if you'd like to follow along. 1 Samuel 21, verse 10 to 15. That day, David fled from Saul and went to Achish, king of Gath. But the servant of Achish said to him, "Isn't this David, the king of the land? Isn't he the one they sing about in their dances? Jesus has slain his thousands and David his tens of thousands." David took these words to heart and was very much afraid of Achish, king of Gath. So he feigned insanity in their presence. And while he was in their hands, he acted like a madman, making marks on the doors of the gate and letting saliva run down his beard. Rather a gross detail there. Achish said to his servants, "Look at the man, he's insane. Why bring him to me? Am I so short of madmen that you have to bring this fellow here to carry on like this in front of me? Must this man come into my house?" It's a strange story, isn't it? And like so often in the Bible, we've got more questions than we've got answered. Was it right for him to do this? Was he trusting God in this? Was it sinful? Was it foolish? Was it just a thing that happened and it's just reporting the truth? Who knows? Because what this writer wants to tell us is that God is keeping David safe. Firstly, as so often in this book, God's people don't notice what the people outside do. Have you noticed that they say, "Isn't David the king of the land?" Technically, no. Saul is the king of the land. But in reality, he's God's king. And they have hit the nail on the head. David's the one that the Israelites should have as their king. They've rejected him. They've sent him away. But of course, this is going to lead to problems for David, because if David is this chosen king, well, let's get rid of him now whilst he's on his own. So, David comes up with this madhat plan of pretending to be insane. And this keeps David safe, even in the courts of his greatest enemies. There are some psalms that David wrote during this time, which show that he's trusting God to help him, even as he uses this plan. And whether it was right or wrong, what we see is that God is using what David does, whether it's foolish, right or wrong, to make sure that David is not going to be killed in the presence of these people. And the final bit to read is 22 verses 1 to 5. David left Gath and escaped to the cave of Adullam. When his brothers and his father's households heard about it, they went down to him there. All those who were in distress or in debt or discontented gathered round him, and he became their commander. About 400 men were with him. From there, David went to Mizpah in Moab and said to the king of Moab, "Would you let my father and mother come and stay with me until I learn what God will do for me?" So he left them with the king of Moab, and they stayed with him as long as David was in the stronghold. But the prophet Gad said to David, "Do not stay in the stronghold. Go into the land of Judah." So David left and went to the forest of Hereth. So David slowly gathers around himself a group. It starts with his father's family and his brother's family. It makes sense that they want to support him. But then there are others that are brought in. And notice who they are. They're the down and outs. They're the dregs. God doesn't choose the brightest and the best. He chooses those who are in most need. He only has 400 men. It's not exactly the kind of army that can take over the throne. But David doesn't intend to fight Saul, remember. He just intends to stay safe until the moment where God appoints him as king. Now, God provides for a way that David's mother and father can be kept safe. If you know your Bible history, you'll know that David was the son of Jesse, who was the son of Obed, who was the son of Ruth and Boaz. And Ruth was a Moabitess. So that's probably why they're feeling safe in Moab. But God has enabled David to keep the fifth commandment, to honor his father and mother, to keep them safe in their old age. But he does send him a prophet to take him back to Judah, where he has the responsibility for the task ahead to be the true king of Israel. Well, what does all this mean for us? Well, as I've said all the way through, the focus isn't so much on David, the great example. Okay? And we're not saying at the end of today, go and lie to people. Go and pretend to be insane. Go and hide out in Moab. That wouldn't make any sense. What it's showing is that God is providing for David, even when it seems like he isn't. When you look at your own life, it's easy to see the places where everything has gone wrong or is going wrong. Perhaps the times you broke God's law like David did when he lied. Perhaps the times when you did something you're now ashamed of, as David must have felt about acting like a madman in those courts, whether it was right or wrong. Perhaps the times you just felt lost and unsure where to go, like he did, wandering around Moab waiting for a revelation. The amazing message of the Bible is that God is in control even in those moments. He turns David's lies to David's provision. He turns David's shame to David's protection. He turns David's lost wanderings to the gathering of a group of men who will support David all his life. Perhaps you've arrived this morning and you're in one of those situations. You've come as one who's broken God's law. You've come as one who's trying to sort out your problems by crazy schemes. You come lost and wondering what God is doing, waiting for a revelation from him. This passage reminds us that if we trust God, he is in control. He is working for our good. David eventually does end as king. There is a happy ending. But God wasn't just in control when everything came together. He was in control all the way along the journey. All these things that happened to David perfectly suited him to be the good king of Israel that he was. And that's the same with you. You can trust God not only in the happy endings where everything works out, but you can trust him to be working in the mess too, and to be using it for his glory. But as well as teaching us about us and our relationship with God, this passage also points us to the Lord Jesus. As we've said throughout 1 Samuel, David is foreshadowing the kind of king that God's going to send, who's really going to sort out the world, Jesus Christ. Now, unlike David, Jesus never sinned, nor did he even do anything that was foolish. But there are certainly times in Jesus' life where things didn't seem to be going the right way. He was born into abject poverty, a refugee, his parents carrying him away as he ran for his life. When he became older and he was a teacher, he was often rejected by the very people who were supposed to accept him. And at the end of his life, of course, he was despised and rejected, crucified on a cross in a position of total shame. But God was at work in all those things. God's poverty in the stable and in escaping to Egypt meant that Jesus could always associate with the poor and the down and out. Jesus' rejection by the authorities meant that he fulfilled all the prophecies about him. Jesus' crucifixion was a great act of God. The lowest point in his life was also the greatest, a moment of salvation. Jesus is greater than David, and that meant not that he escaped suffering, but that his suffering was even greater before he was enthroned as king. What does that mean? Well, Christians, we can't be surprised if life's going to be hard following Jesus. Can't have been easy for those 400 men who gathered around David, can it? And so it is with us. We shouldn't be surprised if life is difficult. But we know that God can even turn our suffering to his good. What about if you're not trusting in Jesus yet? Like David did to those men, he offers you welcome. For David, it was all those who were in distress, all those who were in debt, and all those who were discontented that gathered around him to rescue. Jesus puts it slightly differently. He says, "Come to me, all who are weary, and I will give you rest." Are you in distress? All the pain that is going on in the world right now? Jesus says, "I will give you eternal life and wipe every tear from your eye." Are you in debt, not financially, although that may be the case, but in debt to God because you need to pay the price for your sin? Jesus says, I will take that debt on myself. I died for it on the cross. And you can be set free. Are you discontented with a life that's lived to your own glory? Jesus says, I can give you a contentment that can last in the darkest place because you know that I am by your side. So don't be like Saul. Don't fight against God because that is a fight you're always going to lose. Come to Jesus. Come to him as the true king. And you will see that he brings a greater kingdom than anyone you could construct.